Mortgage rates keep going lower. They've been below 5% for a month and a half this week, and this week they hit all-time record lows. NPR's Joshua Brockman reports.
The average rate for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.7%, according to the weekly survey by Freddie Mac, the mortgage giant. The rate for the same period last year was nearly 5.5%. And even 15-year mortgages are down. They slipped to 4.1%. These are the lowest levels since officials started keeping records in the mid-1960s. Freddie Mac economist Amy Cruz Cutts says interest rates have been on a downward path in recent months.
Especially with the worldwide capital markets in disarray, there's a big flight to quality to the U.S. investments. That includes treasury securities, and mortgage rates have just followed that demand right on down.
Freddie Mac projects rates will stay low through the end of the year, probably below 5.25%. But some realtors, like Brett Ellis with RE/MAX in Fort Myers, Florida, say potential homebuyers aren't recognizing the opportunities in this market.
We've got record low prices, we've got record low interest rates, and it's actually a perfect storm for buyers to buy right now.
Yet mortgage applications have declined. That's according to the latest weekly survey by the Mortgage Bankers Association. Part of the drop is due to the expiration of a federal homebuyer's tax credit, but economists say the unemployment rate is the real drag on the housing market. New reports out this week confirmed home sales declined in May. Joshua Brockman, NPR News, Washington.
Doctors and seniors are breathing a little easier today. This morning, President Obama signed a bill to cancel a 21% pay cut for doctors who treat Medicare patients. But it's only a temporary solution. Unless Congress figures out a way to fix what pretty much everyone agrees is a flawed formula, the cut will return in December. As NPR's Julie Rovner reports, all this raises an important question. Why haven't the nation's doctors been as successful getting their problems fixed as other health industry groups?
Organized medicine isn't exactly jumping for joy now that the 21% cut in Medicare pay has been replaced with a 2.2% raise until the end of November. Cecil Wilson is the president of the American Medical Association.
This is a temporary reprieve for a system that has just gone awry, a program that Congress has made unreliable.
Dr. Wilson's frustration may have something to do with the fact that this is the third time this year Congress has had to cancel the cut, and the second time it's had to do it retroactively. And it's hardly a new problem for lawmakers, he says.
For the last 9 years, they have dropped the ball. Each year they threaten cuts. Each year those threatened cuts get bigger.
But there are some who think it might be the leaders of organized medicine who've dropped the ball. Alec Vachon is a health policy consultant in Washington, D.C. He says hospitals, prescription drug makers, and other groups made sure they got what they needed before they endorsed the health overhaul bill, but not doctors.
Not insisting from the very beginning that any health care reform bill have a permanent fix to this broken update system, that was when they made the mistake. That should have been their demand from day one. We're not going to be supportive of this process unless we can ensure that our members can actually take care of Medicare patients, because right now all that's in jeopardy because of this broken update system.
The original version of the House overhaul bill did fix the doctor payment problem, but the fix was dropped because it cost too much. And Vachon says now that Congress has turned its attention to other things, prospects for spending a lot of money on doctors aren't good.
That was the moment they should have seized. They didn't get it. They didn't insist upon it. And now they have got no leverage.
But AMA President Wilson says there's only one place to put the blame, and it's not on the nation's doctors.
The failure here is a failure of Congress to act responsibly. It is in Congress' lap. Now, we can urge them to do this, and we will continue to apply pressure, but the responsibility to do that is Congress.
Congress now has 6 more months to figure out how to solve the Medicare doctor pay problem. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. The final games of the first round of the World Cup in South Africa were played today, and that means that of the 32 countries that began the competition 2 weeks ago, half are now out and heading home. Tomorrow begins the single elimination phase of the tournament with 2 games, the U.S. versus Ghana and Uruguay versus South Korea. Joining us from Johannesburg is our own Stefan Fatsis. Hi, Stefan.
Hey, Robert.
And before we look ahead, let's look back for a moment. You attended the U.S.'s dramatic 1-0 win over Algeria. How big a win was that?
Well, first, it was the most thrilling end to a major sports event that I have ever witnessed in person, and it was enormously important for a bunch of reasons. One, media. I think a 0-0 draw would have meant three ties by the United States and an early exit from the World Cup, and I think that would have emboldened the dwindling number of media critics of soccer in the United States. Two, the ending demonstrated just how breathtakingly exciting and unifying soccer and this event can be. I really tried afterward to remember the last time you saw these kinds of scenes of explosive, spontaneous celebration over an American team sporting event. And all I could really come up with, Robert, was 1980 in the USA over the USSR in hockey. And that's a long time ago. Three, that game allowed the United States to witness and replay those scenes, a kind of a confirmation that soccer doesn't have to be this isolated phenomenon that's only watched by a small group of people. And finally, the numbers, 8.6 million viewers on ESPN and Univision, the most watched soccer game in ESPN's history.
And I would add number four, Landon Donovan Stanzola, 5'8", the biggest hero in the world on that day. Same size as Pele, by the way. Bill Clinton was at that game, and he's decided to stay along for tomorrow's round of 16 game against Ghana. He's actually there in business.
He is, and I think this is the fifth reason that this win was so important. The former president is the honorary chairman of a bid by the United States to host the 2018, or more likely the 2022 World Cup. The U.S., you'll recall, hosted the 1994 World Cup. Bringing another one to U.S. soil is a major part of the United States Soccer Federation's goals for increasing the sport's momentum. So the morning after Algeria, after the game, Bill Clinton was already booked to meet with members of the FIFA Executive Board. Those are the guys who are going to choose the next World Cup. Cup hosts. 2014 is going to be in Brazil. That's already been taken care of. So this was perfect timing. You got the master schmoozer, Bill Clinton, meeting with these very impressionable international soccer officials who, believe me, were very, very impressed by meeting the former president.
So let's talk about tomorrow's game, U.S. versus Ghana. At the last World Cup in 2006, it was Ghana who eliminated the U.S. in the first round. So this obviously is not a pushover.
No, this is a good team, and here's what I think you should look for. Ghana's very defensive-oriented, very organized. They play with four defenders and five midfielders with just one striker up top on offense. So they don't score a lot, especially since they're missing their best player because of injury, Michael Essien. In fact, Ghana haven't scored two goals in a game since a World Cup qualifier against Mali last November. All three of their first-round games finished 1-0, so the first goal here is going to be crucial. The United States needs to try to get the ball out to the wide, to the sides, to create some space in the middle, and try to attack Ghana's boxed-in defense.
So it's a game the United States could win.
Yeah, and you know what? If they do, they're going to get to play the winner of Uruguay and South Korea, which means that the United States, should they advance two more games, would not have to face one of the world's elite soccer nations until the semifinals of this tournament. They're extremely well positioned to do better in the World Cup than at any time in modern soccer history.
Okay. Thank you, Stefan.
Thanks, Robert.
Stefan Fatsis is writing about the World Cup for NPR, for The New Republic, for Slate, and for SportsIllustrated.com. He joins us most Fridays to talk about sports and the business of sports. And the World Cup mania continues online at our soccer blog. That's at npr.org/cleats. When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. And then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes back. Oh. Born to a throne, stronger than Rome. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This week, our film critic, David Edelstein, reviews two new documentaries. Restrepo is set in Afghanistan and is co-directed by journalist Sebastian Younger, who wrote The Perfect Storm, and war photographer Tim Hetherington. Madeline Sackler's The Lottery centers on high-testing charter schools in Harlem and the drawing that determines who gets in.
Maybe it's a reaction to empty summer escapist movies like The A-Team and Night and Day, but I've had a sudden urge to escape not from, but to reality. If you share that impulse, seek out a pair of unusually urgent documentaries, Restrepo and The Lottery. The grueling Restrepo takes its name from a mountainside outpost in the Korangal region of Afghanistan, where in 2007, Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger got themselves embedded with the 2nd Platoon. That outpost, or OP, takes its name from a charismatic company medic whom we see in video that opens the film. He's on a train with his buddies, they've had a lot to drink, and he's whooping, "We're going to war." Not long after that, Juan Restrepo took two bullets in the neck. OP Restrepo is the site of constant fighting between U.S. forces and the Taliban. The captain, Dan Kearney, describes its impact on the enemy as men show off their artillery.
When the boys built that base, Taliban or the AAF forces in the valley, they were completely in shock. It was like a middle finger sticking out. And they realized once they could not knock off OP Restrepo, we had the upper hand. They started becoming afraid.
Get some, Taliban! Woo!
Hey, hit the bottom right. Hit the bottom right of the village.
Get there!
Those weapons send out balls of fire in long, deadly arcs. But no foreign force is likely to gain the upper hand in this place. The landscape from a distance seems barely marked, the bombs absorbed by the same trees and terraced hills that hide the Taliban, whom we never actually see. We share the perspective of the men who wait for the inevitable assaults, their most trivial exchanges seeming, in this context, momentous. Hetherington and Younger keep filming during the frequent firefights, and you can feel their fight-or-flight instincts in the way their cameras jerk and swerve and point at the ground or the sky. What carnage we see is after the fact, when men gather around the bodies of fellow soldiers, in one case weeping in incomprehension. The directors have said they meant for Restrepo to be objective and apolitical, its focus on the bonds among the men, and what Younger calls in his brilliant new book War, which expands on what we see in the film, the zen of not effing up. What should have been the most hopeful scene in the movie might be the grimmest. Kearney asks Korangali elders, some with beards dyed orange to show they've been to Mecca, to join with him, promising money and new projects, and they stare at him, expressionless. Then seven civilians in the same village are killed in a U.S. operation, and the few hearts and minds that were in play are forever lost. Unlike Hetherington and Younger, director Madeline Sackler sets out to incite and enrage. The Lottery is a devastating piece of propaganda. It unfolds on the home front in New York City, where 3,000 small children apply for 475 slots in charter schools in and around Harlem. These autonomous public schools have been stunningly successful in turning out literate, motivated kids in neighborhoods known for high double-digit dropout rates. But as Sackler profiles four families with children in the running, you get a sinking feeling there are nowhere near enough happy endings to go around. These kids are heartbreakingly open and engaged and eager. But the true focus of the lottery is the battle between Harlem Success Charter School's president Eva Moskowitz and a ferocious coalition of charter school opponents. How, given the high test scores, could the movement create such a violent schism in the community? Charter schools are non-union, and as Sackler frames the fight, it's the teachers' unions that are pulling the strings, using surrogate organizations like ACORN, as it was then called, and Democratic politicians whose campaign chests they fatten. As the lottery presents them, these politicians and community activists come off as working to keep in place a system that is, objectively, a disaster. It makes you wonder whether the kids who lose the lottery are the victims of chance or of forces more frustratingly human.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
A YouTube video is stirring up outrage in the blogosphere. It's the firsthand account of a boat captain in the Gulf accusing BP of burning sea turtles alive while cleaning up the oil spill. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren talked with some of the turtle rescuers to find out what's really going on.
Research scientist Blair Witherington put two and two together a couple weeks ago. He was on a rescue mission 20 miles out at sea near where Deepwater Horizon exploded.
We were out catching turtles in oil lines and witnessing the flames of the fires nearby.
As they did every day, Witherington and his team raced to catch as many turtles as they could. They looked for the coconut-sized animals in skinny lines of oil. The rescuers had to leave the area when it was time for cleanup boats to set the oil on fire.
We knew that we might be missing some, After all, they're just an oily lump amidst lumpy oil. They blend in well.
Witherington says some turtles may be able to swim away from the fires, but he's concerned that others may be getting trapped in the flames. He says it's especially alarming to see turtles at risk because they are so rare, and the majority of the ones getting caught in the oil are Kemp's Ridleys, the rarest of them all.
There's a legal reason to care because they're protected under the Endangered Species Act, and one can't just go about killing sea turtles the way one kills ants or flies. And people really do care about them. I'd like to think that the world is a richer place because we have sea turtles, each and every one of them.
He raised his concerns about the fires with Michael Zaccardi, a veterinarian from the University of California at Davis, who's been coordinating the turtle rescues. Zaccardi says so far Witherington's hypothesis has not been proven.
No wildlife has been reported burned.
But Zaccardi and other experts say there's no question turtles are in the line of fire. The problem is that the oil is collecting in the areas of the Gulf where currents come together. That's where lots of stuff that floats ends up, including golden seaweed called sargassum, which is prime feeding ground for lots of animals, including young turtles.
They're in the same areas that the oil congregates, so they are at high risk.
But after a couple weeks of working on it, Zaccardi says he's now on the verge of putting together a system that should prevent turtles from getting trapped in fires. He's training a team of 20 observers. This week, they're going out with turtle rescue boats to learn how to spot turtles in the oil. Then they'll be sent out with the boats that ignite the fires. Witherington says the observer's job will be to thoroughly examine the pools of oil for turtles before they're set on fire.
The goal is not to allow turtles to die in oil and not to allow them to die in fires set on the sea.
Witherington is not sure why it's taken weeks to come up with this simple solution for preventing turtles from perishing in the burns. He's sorry he wasn't able to push the bureaucracy to move faster, but he was focused on the rescues.
We were very much immersed in a task, and I can't say that I was paying as much attention as I should have.
Witherington says even he can't advocate for stopping the burns because they're a crucial way of keeping the oil from the coastal areas that provide homes for so much wildlife. That includes mature turtles, which are even more essential for keeping the species alive. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Yesterday, we heard about the Harlem Children's Zone, a widely praised program fighting the effects of poverty in a poor section of New York City. Well, now, the Obama administration wants to spread the program around the country by giving out federal grants to what it's calling Promised Neighborhoods. NPR's Larry Abramson reports on whether the effort can be truly replicated in other places or if it will fall apart outside of Harlem.
When community activist Diana Buzza read about plans to clone the Harlem Children's Zone with government funding, she said, "Count me in."
When I read the Harlem Project's success rate, it was like 87% of the children involved increased their academic skills. I was like, my goodness, that's a no-brainer.
But Diana Buzza does not live in a gritty neighborhood in Manhattan. She lives in Cortez, Colorado, one of hundreds of communities applying to be a Promised Neighborhood. With a population of 8,000, Cortez is the center of Montezuma County, a region of high mesas, sandstone canyons, and plenty of low-income families spread out across the Four Corners area.
We have a health advocate who's located over there, and two family advocates who work with families.
Diana Buzza runs the Pinion Project, a community group that helps low-income residents learn how to be better parents, find health care and daycare.
Early Childhood Center. Yeah, they're all sleepy.
In fact, the Pinion Project looks like a small-town version of the Harlem Children's Zone. They have the same suite of wraparound services, parenting classes, advocates in high school to keep kids from dropping out. Still, Stacy Hauser, the school superintendent here, says they're not getting the results they want.
Graduation rate at the high school was 62.7%. For the district, was 52.7%.
Not great.
Well, that's pretty bad.
Here, as elsewhere, the effects of even the finest daycare and parenting programs often fade away as kids get older. It's hard to knit together a checkerboard of services into a lifetime plan that brings long-term results.
Hi, Renelda.
One of the biggest challenges in this area is getting Native American kids to stay in school. Kids like Arnelda Hatali, a Navajo woman who now lives in a small trailer with her boyfriend.
Yeah, I went to MCHS, Montezuma Cortez High School, but I didn't graduate. I stopped about my junior year.
But after years of working in entry-level jobs, Arnelda switched gears and ended up getting her GED at age 28. Her path back to school got started when she was confronted by a clerk in the welfare office.
And it just kind of seemed like she just kind of was, you know, kind of like talking down. And that kind of just made me mad a little bit. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go get my GED. I will get it. Just watch.
Cortez will have to take that random event and turn it into a regular result. But educators here complain the current focus on pre-K leaves them short on funds. So if Cortez does get Promised Neighborhoods money, they'll have to figure out who gets it. During my visit, I was often told that small-town relationships are close. But for a small place, there are a lot of constituencies to satisfy. Hispanics, Navajos living off their reservation, and the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe, with their own reservation down the highway in nearby Toya, Colorado. The tribe already has its own daycare center, but students must then switch to schools in town, where they struggle. Students can study Navajo in high school, but not their own Ute language. That's led many here to support a school on the reservation, saying it would be easier to school kids in their own Ute culture if they had a school here. John Ray Mills, who helps run the daycare center, says that would be a mistake.
Even if we had a school here, I would still send my kids to Cortez because they need that integration and that learning to deal with other people.
Does your husband feel the same way?
No. He doesn't. He's a real pushing for a school here on the reservation.
Whether or not a Ute school would help, it would cost money. Everything does. In New York, Harlem Children's Zone CEO Jeffrey Canada has raised millions thanks to the close proximity of foundations and wealthy donors. Diana Buzza of the Pinion Project says raising money in Cortez is a different story.
In small communities, we don't have foundation support. We don't have large corporations. We don't have any corporations, really.
Would-be Promised Neighborhoods like Cortez are facing a challenge that has bedeviled many anti-poverty efforts in the past, trying to prove that a successful program can be replicated and isn't just a fluke. Larry Abramson, NPR News.